But
okay.
Clarify something as I'm telling the story.
Okay. This is Michael and Carrie Klein here in the Concord Free Public Library boardroom. It's the 24th of May, a beautiful day outside. And would you please say my name is and tell us your name?
My name is Peter Waksman, W-A-K-S-M-A-N.
Oops, and we're not getting any signal there. Say it again.
My name is Peter Waksman, W-A-K-S-M-A-N.
All right.
You want to?
And your date of birth?
12/27/1952. Do we think that's working now?
Yeah.
Okay. You probably don't want to hold that the whole time. You don't want to hold that the whole time, do you?
Yeah. I hold it the whole time.
All right.
I have specially developed muscles for.
That's good, because I don't think I'd want to hold it for that long. So I'm going to tell you who I am.
Why don't you start out, tell us about your people and where you were raised.
I'm going to do that.
All right, good.
That's the first thing I'm going to tell you.
Good.
But the reason I'm here is because I'm a local expert on the archaeology of Concord. I'm a person who gets out and walks around, and I know what's on the surface here. In this generation, I am that expert. There's been one for each generation going back for quite a number of years, but today it's me. So I think that's why I'm here, and I'll put some context around that.
Great.
And I'm going to tell you about arrowheads, and I'm going to tell you about rock piles. Those are the two parts of the story that I want to leave behind, if I may. So who am I? My name's Peter Waksman. I grew up as a child in Lexington, and Lexington's the next town over. We would come to Concord, you know, to go canoeing at the Great Meadows, and I think for some of the parades and things around Patriots Day. So I remember, for example, the Penny Candy store up at what became the Nature Company, and now it's become a faceless boutique. I remember the tricorn hats in the parade and buying raccoon tails so that we could be like Swamp Fox, you know, and the Disney show. We thought that was cool. And we came to Concord, and we paddled around, and we looked at the turtles and the herons and the ducks, and I remember the cage with the otters in it beside the river, but I'm sure a lot of other people remember those things, too. I remember skating on the river when I was a kid. But then we moved away. I came back. I have a background. I have a PhD in mathematics, and I work in the technology area. We came to Concord. I got a job in West Concord a few years after I was married, and we've been living. Well, first we lived in Acton, then the housing market dropped, and it was briefly possible to get into Concord, and we did what we could, and we've been poor ever since. It's an expensive town to live in. I live in the poorer parts out along Route 62 on the way to Bedford. But nevertheless, it's my town. I know things about the town that nobody else knows, so I know some of the secrets, which I hope to tell you. This thing is disturbing. It's distracting.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Let's see. Now I'm going to basically focus my story on the part which I know something special about. I don't think you could interview any Concordian. They would tell you the same sorts of things that I could tell you. I had kids that went through the schools. My oldest son was president, whatever they call it, captain of the fencing team at Concord Carlisle High School. I have three sons that are going through the school system. These sorts of things I think are probably standard. I guess what I want to talk about is the archaeology. You know, how did I get interested in it, and how that came to be. So I was doing some summer reading about the Neanderthals and, you know, the Aryan races and this, that, and the other, and then I went to an exhibit at the Concord Museum, which was called From Musketaquid to Concord. It had a little pamphlet that was produced by the museum. I think Shirley Blankey, their resident archaeologist, had written it. And what I learned there in this exhibit, and this is maybe 15 years ago, was that there were Indians in Concord. I guess that's sort of a no-brainer. Now I realize there were Indians everywhere, and everybody should know very well that there were Indians everywhere. But at the time, you know, you're just living in this nice suburban town. It doesn't occur to you that, you know, there were people here before. And one time I was dozing on the sofa thinking, well, if there were people here for, let's see, how long was that? Let's see, something like 10,000 years. well, gosh, that's a long time. They must have left some kind of traces behind. There must be something. The Concord Museum has arrowheads and nice museum pieces there, but you're thinking, well, there must really be more than just a few arrowheads. So I walked right out of my yard, walked up to the first rock in my yard. It was a big rock, and there was a channel ground into the top of the rock, smooth, parallel. Obviously, somebody had been rubbing a stone back and forth on that forever. And so I go, huh, what's that? And I start looking around. A lot of the rocks, the larger rocks around here, the fine-grained ones, the igneous rocks, were used as grinding stones for corn, or in this case, since it was a channel as opposed to a basin, I think it was probably for polishing one of the polished stone tools that they made, the axes or the whatever these call them, celts or celts and gouges and things. So, I mean, as soon as you start looking for traces of the past, they're all over the place. People don't recognize them. They just drive right by them. But to me, it's a fascinating narrative, the fact that there's archaeology everywhere. There's probably archaeology right outside this window if you put your feet into the... scrape up some of the dirt with your... get your fingernails dirty, you'll see stuff. And so what I started doing... one of the books was this pamphlet. Another book I read was saying things about, this is what broken rocks look like. When man breaks a rock, this is what it looks like. It leaves a particular characteristic concave facet, sort of a cone of percussion. Just like you remember when a BB goes through a window, do you remember what that looks like? Punches a little cone through the window. Do you know that? The interviewers are not responding. They're nodding. Yes, they know that, what I'm talking about. Anyway, the cone of force punches a cone through a window, and if you hit a rock in a very sharp and precise spot, it also produces a cone, except usually most of the cone's out in the midair, and just part of the cone is removed from the rock, leaving a concave, curved facet. And it's the only way you can get that kind of a breakage pattern. You have to apply force at a point. So anywhere in the world where you're walking, you see concave faceted rocks, those are made by man. And when I first heard that, I go, well, wait a minute, I've been seeing those types of rocks all my life. So I went out to look for some, and sure enough, there are stone tools everywhere. Most of them are crude. Most of them are of no interest to anybody. In Concord, I'm going to tell you things which I believe to be true. I'm considered a flaky, fringe kind of guy. I don't want to spend too much time trying to defend my point of view versus what I consider the conventional point of view. I'm just going to say what I believe is the case, and other people can sort out my opinion from other opinions. It's not currently believed that there is such a thing as a disposable stone tool. Everybody believes that stone tools have to be these beautiful things, you know, just like you see in the museums. It's just not true. 95% of what they made out of cheap, crappy rock, and they threw it away after using it very briefly. The fields are full of broken rocks, and they're full of broken, man-made broken rocks. They're packed with them. You will have a hard time finding a rock that hasn't been broken in this town. Honest, you got to go look. And actually, if you go deep down into the glacial till around here, which is 12 feet deep in places, you still find broken rocks. And you go, what the heck? How did those get there? Anyway, so that's a separate story. But I went out
glacial
into...
glacial till?
That's stuff that's supposedly the rubble that the glacial pushed aside. Whether... how it got to be there is, I don't know, a more complicated story. But in some cases, you find stuff mixed in with that, which makes you wonder, was there somebody here before the glacier? Well, we can come back to that question. Surely there were people here before the glacier. There were people in all other parts of America before the glacier. At least that's currently believed by the conventional wisdom. In any case, I read a book that told me what to look for in the way of broken rocks. I went out into the field behind Fox House, which is on Route 62. I started picking up rocks, and I just thought, is this a stone tool? Is this a stone tool? Things like, you know, a curved edge with serrations along the edge of it. You know, very clearly, like toothed serrations. You go, this must be a stone tool, because look, each one of these is individually made little serration. I don't know what this is for. I've never seen a picture of anything like this, because, you know, the collectors don't notice the crap. They notice the fancy, pretty stuff. They don't notice the bulk of what's out there. And really, it's of no interest to anybody, except for the first-time hunter, the collector, who's going out and looking carefully, because if you get to recognize faceted rocks, you'll see them everywhere. You see them on the beach, for example, and you go, what the heck were they doing with huge stone tools on the beach? Well, they must have been butchering sea mammals. I don't know. The stuff is all over the place. So in the field behind Fox House, I wandered around for quite a while looking for broken rocks, and I found a few things that I thought were stone tools. And then I sort of circled out from my home, which is in that eastern part of town, and I circled further and further out, looking at every patch of dirt that was there. Now, in New England here, everything's covered with leaves and grass. There's very few examples of bare dirt. Traditionally, it would be where the fields were plowed would be a place that you could look. You could see the bare dirt. You can also see bare dirt where a house is being built, where a sewer is being put in, where a bank is eroding. And I would go around. In the wintertime, there wouldn't be a whole lot of bare dirt available, but I'd find a couple of inches of bare dirt along the top of an eroding bank, and I'd go looking right through it. Or there'd be a housing project in Acton, and I'd go pull rocks out of the basement cellar holes that they dug, and just keep at it and keep looking at things and trying to see patterns and make sense out of it. And I tried to make sense out of it. Finally, and I got as far away from my house as Asparagus Farm, which is closer to town here. It's out Route 62, which is called Bedford Road. There's the cemetery, Sleepy Hollow's on the left, and you go down to a dip that's called Cemetery Brook, and you come back up, and then you're into this Asparagus Farm is on your left. And once I got to that place and started walking around, I found my first arrowhead. I found a real arrowhead. And I go, oh, wow, that's beautiful. Cool. And then I found another one the same day. I was like, this must be the right place to be. So I started mining that resource. And I going back to the fields between Route 62 and the wastewater treatment facility. And over time, I collected maybe 60 arrowheads, which I have. Maybe the interviewers will take photographs of these if they want. And this is the first arrowhead I ever found in Concord. Isn't that fun? And come back to that later. It's nothing too dramatically beautiful, but gosh, it's really fun to find something like that. It's a real treat.
It's a little bit dramatic.
I think it is.
It's nothing compared to some of these nicer ones. But anyway, we can go into this in more depth later. Look at that. I'm afraid these are sort of scrambled up at the moment. This is supposed to be over here. Okay. Well, anyway, we can look at the arrowheads later. It doesn't tape record very well. But once I started finding real arrowheads, it's almost like I never looked back. I never looked at the crappy stuff again, although I have a house full of drawers of old crud. For example, an Indian woman sewed, right? And believe me, pushing a bone needle through a piece of hide is not easy. Now, in traditional sewing, when you have that problem, you use something called a thimble, right? So do you think a primitive person would ever need something like a thimble? The answer is, oh, you bet. They'd use it constantly. What's a thimble look like? Who knows? So coming at that a different way, as you're walking through the fields, looking at every single rock you can see, trying to decide should I pick it up or not, you get to know certain materials that are not from Concord, and you know that those are not from Concord, therefore somebody brought it here, therefore it's worth looking at. And those are the sort of the fancy exotic, they're called because they're not from here, exotic lithics. But you also notice, and that's how you find arrowheads, not because you see something that looks like an arrowhead, but because you see something made out of an exotic material that you know that that's an unusual material. You pick it up, 90% of it will be underneath the surface. You pick up, you see a little corner, you pick it up, go, oh my God, it's an arrowhead, or, oh, boo, that was a disappointment. But as you walk along, you get to know what's a normal, random, uninteresting rock versus a rock that you want to take a closer look at. And one of the things you'll see are rocks that are more polished than the other ones. You go, well, wait, that's more polished than it should be. It's just shinier than it should be. You know all the other rocks. Here's one that's shiny. It's made out of the same thing as the other rocks. Why is it shiny? Shiny because it was in somebody's pocket for a long time. That's or the equivalent. And then you find one that's got a cupped hollow in it. It's about a half an inch across with a cup in it, and it's polished most in the interior of the cup. Now, that ain't easy to do, even if it's sitting in your pocket, because things don't typically touch the interior surface of a hollow. So I'm finding these little things. I'm saying, how would you hold that, and what is it for? Finally, it's like, oh, that fits right here, and the hollow facing out, and you could push a needle. I don't know, but I have to come up with some explanation for why is that thing polished. And the answer that I come up with is, well, because it was held, and in this case, it could have been held and used as a thimble because it fits in your hand. It's got a hollow for holding the back end of the needle, and it's polished where it would be. And so this could have been used for a thimble. And that's all I really know, is that this sort of thing might have been used as a thimble. But like it or not, there are artifacts out there that need to be examined and explained. They don't all look like arrowheads. In fact, you've got to imagine that hunting was a small fraction of the overall activity. Women didn't do it. So, for example, what were they using to get about their daily lives? And you believe they were working hard all the time. It wasn't just with their bare hands. They had tools, too. But they don't. You have to fill in the gap there. What did they look like? So, I, at the time, because I'm a technology sort of person, I was also involved. You know, I knew I was online on the web. I was a reasonably early adopter. I don't know, I'm not the earliest of adopters, but by the time you could browse Internet Explorer, I was trying to create web pages at that time. And I noticed that there were people out there with pictures of their arrowheads online. I thought, I'll do that too. If I find something nice, I'll take a picture, I'll put it online. Let's make sure the world, because you feel a little guilty taking an arrowhead up off the ground. Even though you know you're rescuing it from obscurity, you still feel like you're stealing, sort of. So you've got to feel like, well, I got to give something back. And frankly, I don't really think these belong to me. I think they belong to the town. I just happen to have them in my possession. So I'm in control of their destiny, but that doesn't mean that I own them. And I haven't decided who's going to get them. This library does not deserve to get them. Somebody, the guy who bought this library, said, I want this library devoted to showing my arrowheads off and to display and for books. And then when the library decided that it was no longer convenient for them to do that part of the legacy, they put stored computers in the room that was designed for showing the arrowheads. So this place had a tradition. It was a beautiful little alcove for showing arrowheads here, which many of the older people will remember and tell you about. I don't know where it is today. But these guys, they took the arrowhead collection. You read the original, I've gathered, the original legacy gift for this library is the Monroe Library. Mr. Monroe said, here's the money, here's what you're supposed to do with it. You're supposed to open this is for the edification of the residents of Concord, including books, the Indian arrowheads, this, that, and the other. And so they took all the arrowheads, they put them in a box, and they gave them to the Concord Museum, and there they sit, and you don't have access to them anymore. I've asked permission. You know, you don't have an academic credential, so you don't deserve to look at the arrowheads anymore. I consider that to be a shame, and I'm not going to let my arrowheads suffer that fate. I'd rather have them be in my family than be in a closet at the Concord Museum. But
or that's library. Or did you mean?
Well, no, they went to the Concord Museum. The library gave away that which they didn't really have the right to give away, as far as I know, and now they're lost to the public, and I think that's too bad. The Concord Library does what it can, but it has a lot of other priorities besides the archaeology of Concord, and it doesn't have a lot of exhibit space. So, whatever, that's sad. And I need to stay focused on my outline.
I'm so glad you said all that.
Yeah, well, I got to try to remember the stories that you really want to hear, probably not the ones I'm going to tell. So it's like, why didn't you tell us this when we had them there? But I was just trying to say that I got involved with web pages, and I had a digital camera because there happened to be one at work that I borrowed long term. I gave it back eventually. But I had this digital camera early on, before there were digital cameras everywhere. So I was taking pictures of arrowheads, putting them online. People would find my stuff online. I became kind of the only website with Massachusetts arrowheads, and I'm still the only website with Massachusetts arrowheads. The state of Massachusetts has only got one arrowhead picture in its entire resources online. It's like the non-existence of the Native Americans is a persistent thing in the way that archaeology is handled in the state. Massachusetts simply does not have archaeology. If you ask the state of Massachusetts, if you look, I could go on and on, but I'm very much an anti-authoritarian, and as far as I'm concerned, the people who are in charge of archaeological resources are crooks. I don't know if they're taking money, but they've done nothing to protect the archaeological resources of the state. It's pitiful. It's sad. And I mean, maybe it's easy for me to point fingers without knowing all the details. There's some museums that house the collections, but it's the same all over. You go to the Smithsonian, right? A place with hundreds of thousands of arrowheads that have been given to the Smithsonian. And you say, well, where are the arrowheads? They go, well, we don't have any. They're not on display. Well, where could I look? Well, maybe if you go look in the, maybe over in the natural history section. It's like, what happened to our archaeology? We have a very rich, fascinating archaeology here. And the picture is, I got to keep staying on track. So wait a second, I'll come back to the general picture. But I did web pages. And this brought me to the attention of various people. I'm a member, I was on the board of directors of a group called the New England Antiquities Research Association. They wanted me to do their webpage. I got involved with them. They're a group that's interested in the stone works that are in the woods around here, because there's plenty of things that don't fit the standard line about colonial farming. And I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about the rocks that are in the woods, above ground stone structures, just to give you a preview. A vision quest requires a little enclosure where you sit. It's called a prayer seat. Okay, and our woods are full of prayer seats in and around, and nobody ever notices them. The Indians had vision quests everywhere up the wazoo around here, and the signs of them doing that are everywhere up the wazoo around here. They're all over the place, but if you don't know what to look for, you just sort of ignore it. You walk right by it, and I'll get into that more. But what with one thing and another, I had a fight here in the town with the cemetery people. It was a constructed fight. It was an artificial fight. It was a fight I tried to pretend that I wanted to battle them out, because they were expanding into that asparagus farm area I was telling you about, and where a place where I had collected many wonderful arrowheads. And I didn't really like the idea of them bulldozing it without so much as a thank you very much. Right? The town had lost track of its own archaeology. Its major resources are the ones right there, just beyond Cemetery Creek. This has been documented thoroughly by previous generations of people, but there was nobody alive that remembered that stuff, and the Historical Commission doesn't have the kind of continuity that would remember that, gee, we shouldn't go bulldozing over there because there's archaeological sites. So I brought it to everybody's attention in superficially subtle way as possible. It made it look like I was being under the table, but I was also threatening that I was going to make it above the table. And so I scared them into giving me a little teeny chunk of the cemetery, and I got to put up a little monument anyway and says, there were Indians here, there were artifacts, there were arrowheads. We can stop and think for a moment about that time 10,000 years ago and up until now, before we get back in our cars and drive on and continue with our modern lives. So I think I'm proud of having got to do that, and I think that that is all why I'm here, because I came to the attention of the town. I got to be on the board of the Concord Historical Commission. So I was a historical commissioner for a while. That felt good. Until they got some money, before they had any money, and when they were a powerless group, it was a lot of fun being a Concord Historical Commissioner. But once they got the Community Preservation Act money, so there were actually some dollars associated with being on the Concord, then it stopped being fun. They got official. I don't know what happened. It stopped being fun. It used to be a very laid-back thing, an opportunity to meet some of the older Concordians with their own histories and stories about the place. So that's why I'm here, okay? I was going to tell you more about arrowheads for a few minutes, and then I was going to tell you more about stone mounds and the Indian archaeology, the above-ground archaeology that's all over the place around here, and end up telling you about what's happening today.
Great.
So we can take a pause. Is there any part of the story that seems like it needs a little bit more clarification? I suppose I'm rambling all over the place.
Even as a member of the Historical Commission, you didn't have access to the...
I could have forced the issue. To the arrowheads at the museum? Yeah. I could have forced the issue. Plus, I know Shirley Blanke reasonably well. She's helped me understand the arrowheads that I did collect, what they're made out of, what the styles are, what the date, the approximate date that those things were made. So I probably could, but, you know, it's just their archive's not open to the public, so if I got permission, someone would have to go up there with me, and they'd have to unlock it, they'd have to keep me under a careful eye because, you know, some people probably consider me a pot hunter. I consider myself to be the only person who not only is collecting but is trying to communicate about archaeology. So the people who collect and then put stuff in a storeroom and remain silent on it, to me, they're the vandals, right? And I hear stories about the Southwest and about the pot hunters. Those damned pot hunters keep vandalizing sites. Well, have you ever been to a site that the archaeologists have vandalized? It's incredible. They leave nothing. Vandals at least leave odds and ends of stuff around, but the archaeologists, they could go through totally wipe the place clean, and all that appears is some obscure report somewhere in the library, and that doesn't help the public any. So in a way, it's the hoarders versus the publicationers, whatever you call that. I try to make my discoveries available to the public, and that's the only thing I can do ethically. I'm not stealing these things, but...
So it sounds like the real issue for you is accessibility.
Accessibility also, but the minimum would be
whether
accessibility.
Whether it's the Smithsonian or whether it's the local museum.
I haven't thought through any kind of general statement here. I think it's too bad that archaeology isn't a little bit more mainstream in what the kids love it. They love to hear about this stuff. There's no programs where they get to. There's certainly programs where they get to know about Thoreau, and there's certainly programs where they get to know about Louisa May Alcott, and maybe some of the less famous people like Hawthorne or Emerson. They get to hear about them, and Bronson Alcott. That's part of their tradition growing up here in Concord and becoming good writers. But, you know, walking in the woods should also be part of your tradition of growing up in Concord, and knowing what's in the woods should be there too. And it's not just what Thoreau was not the last authority on what was in the woods. He was only the first of many potential authorities. Anyway, so there's a lot of stuff going on in Concord that isn't literary and that's of interest. And the Concord Museum does a great job in some things, and I just wish that they'd do more. I've wished that Concord had an archaeology museum. It really needs one. There's more than enough material to fill multiple museums here. I'm an employed guy. I gotta work for a living, except for today, which I took off. But if I was one of the landed gentry around here, I think some efforts at creating an archaeology museum for the public would be well worth it. There's an interest. There's everything you need. Probably grant money if you were willing to go after it. So that's too bad that it can't be. Because there's a lot of stuff that, who knows what to do with it, really. So I got started looking at arrowheads, as I was telling you. I'm now into the section of my outline called arrowheads, and I'll spend a few minutes on this. I got started because I read books about the Neanderthals and about Concord prehistory and about stone tool manufacturing, and it led me to go start walking around. I'd been walking around, you know, taking my weekend walks, looking at ducks and looking at ferns, but now I started looking at the rocks, and I never looked back. I've been looking at the rocks ever since. I found arrowheads. I'm mostly from Eastern Concord, is where the big cornfields are. Now, there probably were Eastern Concord, meaning eastern end of town. There are lots of cornfields over here, Western Concord, Southwestern Concord. They're further from my house. I don't know if I'm trespassing. I get kind of nervous walking out in the middle of a field. You don't want to be walking on the corn. Farmers legitimately get pissed off at you if you trample on their crops. And even if you're walking carefully, they don't know you're walking carefully, and you can get chased out of anywhere. And I like it when I get chased out politely by the right people, and I don't like it when I get chased out impolitely by the wrong people. I hate Lincoln. Because they've chased me out impolitely. I tell them, look, you didn't know there was an archaeological site here. I'm putting you on the map. No, we're not interested. You're not allowed to do that. Get out of here. I got chased out of Littleton yesterday for different reasons, trespassing on a guy's property. So I hesitate to go exploring in the southwestern parts of town around White's Pond, up by the rifle range, out by the prison. These are places where there are open fields where one could explore. And eventually I did get over into some of those fields and explored them too, but I didn't get to know them as well. What I found was in Eastern Concord you have, well, most obviously you have the standard mid-archaic cultures, which includes the stemmed point, the Merrimack cultures, and the concave base Brewerton point cultures. Okay, and I could show you two different types of arrowheads, and I guess this is probably one time when I can tell you one of the stories about these two different groups. It's that story. So that's some of what I found in the east, and I found something else in the east which I want to tell you about also, which is the lake shores, which is even earlier than the Middle Lake Archaic. And then I found stuff out on the western Concord out by the prison, and I want to tell you about that. Those are the late paleo sites. The oldest archaeological sites in Concord that I know of are out by the prison, and those are 8, 9, 10,000-year-old sites, little teeny fluted points, little things like the great game hunters, only little teeny versions of them made out of quartz. So let me tell you what I found where. Actually, this is a good time. So there's two types of arrowheads that you find in Concord at Asparagus Farm behind Ripley School over in that part of town. One type have stems like this. They look like Christmas trees. Okay. The other type have, more sort of a flat base. This one's broken. But sometimes they're eared. Sometimes they're flat. They're sort of like that. Sometimes they look a little bit like a jet airplane as opposed to a Christmas tree. And those are the two arrowhead shapes that are most traditional at Concord. The stemmed ones are called Merrimack points and or Stark points I've forgotten the name for it. And these other ones, these flatter, concave-based ones with the ears on the corners, these are called Brewerton points, and they have various names. So Brewerton. Now, what's interesting, this is very interesting to me, as you look at the materials that the stemmed points are made out of. None of these materials come from Concord, okay? So you can say, where did they come from? Well, maybe this came from Concord. Put that away. That spoils my story. So here, this first arrowhead of all. This is made out of a bluish, fine-grained, slaty material. It's called argillite. It's also called Cambridge blue mudstone. And like other materials that the stemmed points are made out of, it comes from east of here. So the good exotic lithic sources for stemmed points come from east of Concord, along the rivers and the waters down to the sea. Stemmed points are also found along the coast, north into Labrador, over into Europe, and right over into Italy. That's where stemmed points are found. It's North Atlantic cultures, okay? These things are associated with the red paint people in the very far past. They're associated with things like deep water fishing. They found swordfish remains in association with stemmed points like this. Okay, these guys were living in the North Atlantic probably before the Bronze Age, probably around 5 to 6,000 BC, so 7 or 8,000 years ago. And they exist in America down, I don't know, into the Carolinas, right? But it's a coastal maritime culture, and the sources of the materials here in Concord are from east of here. By contrast, the Brewerton points are made from materials that come from west of here. And the style is very different. One could make a reasonable case for how the style of the Brewerton points is an evolutionary development that began with the fluted points and the great game hunters from there. You can make that case. But in any case, too many uses of the word case, nevertheless, these materials are from the west. These materials for the stem points are from the east. And here's the interesting things. These guys more or less overlapped in time in Concord. And yet, their materials remained different. Their styles of arrowheads remained different. And I'm not talking about 20 days here and there of overlap. I'm talking about 2,000 years. That's a long time. Where both of these cultures came to Concord, went their separate ways, and never intermarried, never mingled, never shared, never developed a common style of arrowhead. So what are we talking about? Here's my story. There were two different groups of people in Concord, and they hated each other. They must have. They must have been like, oh, black versus white, kill them, or something, because, you know, their arrowheads didn't ever become one. They remained separate cultures right up until the late Archaic, at which point you have the small-stemmed small points, and maybe I'm wrong. I don't really know what happened after that. But I do know that for a long time in there, they were separate and they remained separate. So you got to put a human face, if you can, behind this. These people, they must have bumped into each other, and yet it wasn't a happy meeting. This is my story. Maybe it's wrong, but who's going to say I'm wrong, right? I will say that my statements about the materials are probably verifiable. And so if somebody wants to check, there's some elements of my story that are, you know, subject to more than just my opinion. You can actually go look at it. So that's my story. The first economy of Concord, of course, was, at least in eastern Concord, if you want to try to put together the story, all these arrowheads are concentrated just on the far edge of Cemetery Brook. Now, you have, I'm gesturing with my hands. The microphone won't show up, but I'm waving off to my left. I'm facing east, okay? And to my left is the Concord River, okay? And in front of me is the east. And Concord River is called the Concord River because two major rivers have a concordance here, which is the Sudbury and the Assabet Rivers. So we're at basically a huge crossroads of the river system here. It means this was a crossroads in the highway of early people who traveled by boat. You don't travel on foot, you travel by boat. Your family goes by boat. That's the way how you get around. And these rivers go everywhere. You can get anywhere you want by river. Concord is the way you get from Canada to Cape Cod. Because if you want to get from Canada to Cape Cod, you come down the Merrimack River somehow. Maybe you get into this river system from the Connecticut River. I'm not sure how you get over to here. You get onto the Nashua River, you come over in here, and then somewhere around Harvard, you jump from the Nashua River over into the Assabet River, Elizabeth Brook, and then you can come up Elizabeth Brook, and then you could go off to where the Sudbury starts down in central Massachusetts and Upton, or you could go down a little ways, and in particular, as relevant to this story, you can hop over into the Charles River water system, and the way you hop from the Concord River to the Charles River is going along Cemetery Brook up into the bogs and ponds that are today on the back of Revolution Ridge. And then there was and Hanscom Field, which is today a flat airport, used to be a marsh and lakes, and they were filled in with water. And so from there, you can hop over a very short ridge, and then you're into the... There's a very short portage between Hanscom Field and the Charles River. In fact, Hanscom Field's almost at the watershed divide. So these are the lakes that you follow when you get... So this is the highway. The portages are going up through here along Cemetery Brook. And they all got out and camped there, and that's where all the arrowheads are. But I'm remembering, and I forgot to tell you the story about the lake shore. So don't let me forget that. I want to come back and tell you the story about the lake shore. Anyway, all the arrowheads, the largest concentration of arrowheads are right along the eastern edge of Cemetery Brook. Now, this is where the Minutemen ran around behind to ambush the British. Now, you've probably heard the story about the fight at the North Bridge, and you will have heard that the British retreated in orderly fashion, quote-unquote, and that the farmers, wily, resilient Yankee farmers with their... You got to laugh at that story. I mean, you got something like 20 British standing on one side of the bridge and something like 20 farmers on the other side of the bridge, and they all shoot at each other, and only one person is hit. It's like, that can't be a very effective weapon, right? 40 of them go off, and one of them actually makes contact, and we're talking about a short distance. Anyway, so the farmers ran around the backwoods way, which is to say the Cemetery Brook portage way, right? They're following the old trails up from the river there. And the British followed the new trail out of town towards Lexington. And the hardy, resilient Yankee farmers met them at Miriam's Corner. But in any case, the route that the Yankee farmers were following there was the same route as the Indians portaging up out of the river and over towards the Charles. Now, this was a big area, the Hanscom Field area. Now, I'm going to tell you another story. And you need to look at the 45-meter topo line on the maps in eastern Concord. It more or less marks a division between a highland and a lowland. So in any place in eastern Concord that you're walking around, you'll notice a drop-off into a kind of a floodplain area, right? So over here on the left, you'll have a drop-off into the Concord River. Over here on the right, you have these marshy, flat, boring expanses between Concord and Bedford with a few little hills sticking out of them, little few outcrops, which is now today's Hanscom Field. But before that, what was it called? Bedford Levels. It was called Bedford Levels, and I don't know to what extent it had been irrigated or drained or what have you. Presumably, but if you look all through that area, walking along at around the 45-foot topo line, there's a drop-off of about 8 feet. I'm pulling out my map just so I can sort of show the interviewers what I'm talking about. But see, is it right here, see, just right along here. I'm showing them a big patch of Hanscom Field, okay? Hanscom Field's totally flat, and then you have a first topo line, and then you have another one that's the 45. You see how it says 45 right there?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that spot, there's a drop-off. So this big flat area is divided, if you like, by ridges or hills or higher land. Back when this, a little bit of flooding, even in a wet year, this will start to flood. The only way in and out of town is along this ridge. I'm showing them Route 62. Route 62 goes along a ridge, but on either side of Route 62, it's wetland. And the more you look at it, the more you can be convinced that long ago, these weren't just marshes. They were actually were lakes. And then we'll tell you about Glacial Lake, what was it? Framingham, Glacial Lake Framingham. So when the ice was, this is maybe 13, maybe 15,000 years ago, the ice was up here in the north, right, weighing down the land. Now, all the land was sort of tipped a bit that way, and there was a big lake of water just filling up everything. And some of these conquered, a few things would have been islands. Conquered would have stuck up in the form of a few islands sticking up. So at that point, when there were glacial, there were seals and things in Concord at that time, right? Things with marine ivory, right, living in there. And we don't know if there was Paleo-Indians living in Concord at that time. We don't know. But then what happened was is that the ice broke and the water flooded out, okay? And then after that, the land bounced back. It's called glacial rebound of some kind. Like you remove the weight of the ice, and the land goes like this over 100 or 1,000 years. It's like, I don't know. But I'm looking at it, and I'm going, you know, I find a certain type of stone tools all along this 45 line, and they're not arrowheads, although I found a couple of arrowhead-like things. They're more like scrapers or knives or just things, cheap crap. These guys didn't have good stone to work with, but they had jobs to do. And I make up the following story, which is that there was a culture of people that lived along the lakeshore. They were not arrowhead users. They were fishing people. They used, I thought I found a barb, sort of a spear, something that might have been embedded. I have a barb made out of slate. It's like a hook, with a sharp hook. And I found it at the lowest point on Maplewood Farms over here. And, you know, it's just very interesting. If you walk, for example, do you know where Maplewood Farms is? That's along, it's right here. So it's Sunnyside, what's it called? Sunnyside Lane. I don't want to get into this too much. But you can walk from the highland down to the lowland behind Maplewood Farm, which is a farm stand right here. You can just walk from here where you're high, slowly, gradually down into where it's low. And you just look at the ground and how it changes, how the soil changes. And if you look for broken rocks, you can look at how the broken rocks change. But at the very lowest point, I found a hook made out of slate. Nothing very pretty, but I go, yeah, that's manufactured. I don't know what it's for. Looks like a hook of some kind. So I see fishing having taken place here. And these people, the very, very first economy of Concord was sort of a, you know, hunter-gatherer, not a hunting, but sort of like a fishing-gathering culture around the lake shores. And then these lakes dried up, and then the land rebounded, and there might have been a second lake, and I don't know what the timing is. I don't know the geology, the details. But there's a very clear demarcation on the 45 line here. And curiously enough, it doesn't exist over here in western Concord and southern Concord. At least I haven't seen it over there, which makes me think that when it rebounded, it tipped. So today, the 45 line is meaningful, but it became a different height somewhere else in Concord. So there's a similar drop-off, but look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's still at 45. But you can look at these maps. The last big topo line before the flats is always 45 meters, I guess that is. So I don't know. I think that there was a lakeshore culture. So I find things that I think are from them. And then separately from them, I find stuff out in the west of Concord that I think is Paleo-Indian stuff. And they arrived by canoe. They always talk about the great game hunters. You've probably heard these stories, these noble savages who extinguished all the megafauna in America, you know. These hardy Yagi hunter-gatherers, before they were Yagis, but you've probably heard these stories about them chasing the mammoths to extinction, this, that, and the other. You know, this is the popular standard story, the great game hunters. And the story that they don't tell you is that certain varieties of mice became extinct at the same time. So
there was more going on than just the hunting of mammoths. So certain varieties of owl became extinct at around the same time. And actually, the extinction didn't happen all at once the way they like it to sound. Somehow around 10,000 BC, all the big animals in America died. It's not true. They'd been dying out since 30,000 years or so ago. In any case, the great game hunters, if you look at the distribution of the fluted points, I'm holding up my hands and making an outline of a Folsom point or a Clovis point, which I'm not sure the interviewers know the name, but you've seen these things where they show you a point that's shaped like that. No? The Discovery Channel things. The Smithsonian's got some beautiful ones, but you have to know Dennis Stafford in order to get access to them. Anyway, over time, their arrowheads got smaller. And if you look at the distribution of fluted points, if you look at a map of America, and where all of the fluted points that have ever been found in America, where they were found, it's along the rivers. It's not in the middle of nowhere. These guys were boat users. It's not really very consistent with the pictures in the back of the Time Life series on great game hunting, where you always see these guys with furs looking slightly different than the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons, but not much different. Same artistic concept. But the reality is these guys were in boats. They were in boats on the Mississippi, they were in boats on the Assabet, they were in boats on the Atlantic, but as far as I can tell, that's a different group of people. Meanwhile, back here with the fluted point people, they were certainly coming up into Concord on the Assabet River, and they were certainly along the Neshoba Brook, and they were certainly in the cornfields north of Warner's Pond. Out behind the prison, there's some big cornfields, and I have found spear thrower counterweights there. I have found a large number, not a large number, but like four, little teeny quartz triangles that are said to be hard to tell apart from something else. So these are called Hardaway-Dalton points. Let's see if I have one. Hardaway-Dalton, or Dalton-Hardaway, I'm not sure what the order is there.
H-A-R-D-A.
Yeah, that's Hardaway. Yeah, Hardaway.
Dalton.
Yeah, look at this just before. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's just a stemmed point. I'm looking for my Hardaway Daltons in here.
Is Hardaway Dalton an archaeologist?
Dalton, I think it was a site, the name of the farm where they first identified this type of arrowhead. I'm trying to just find them by feel. Let me put these away.
It's all right.
Well, it's not all right. I want to get this put back. Sorry.
Well, sure.
I should keep talking while I do it. But anyway, so I'm looking for the little quartz triangles. I know they're in here somewhere. I'm not sure where. Could it be that? No. We're still into the stem points there. Yes, there we go. This is actually not from what I'm talking about. This is the type of thing I'm talking about. Curtis Hoffman, who is the current editor of the Bulletin of the Mass Archaeology Society, and I think... Mass Archaeological Society. Curtis Hoffman, he's a professor at Bridgewater State. I think he also was a... He said he thought that was a little teeny Clovis point. And he is the most knowledgeable person about arrowheads in Massachusetts. So I'm going to go with that because I like that. But I don't actually think it's
a Clovis point.
It's a miniature Clovis point. I actually don't think it is reasonable to call it a Clovis point. I think it's more reasonable to call it a Hardaway Dalton. See that? That's a fluted point. Can you see the flute?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. It's a teeny one. It's not like these huge Smithsonian beauties, but that's what that is. And these come from Warner's Pond area. And if you're wondering where in that big field to go to look, I'll tell you a little brag, which is that I had spent 4 years walking around that field, an hour here, an hour there, and I never found anything. But I just felt that I had to keep looking because it's part of the job. And then I started saying, well, this is a big field. If I was an arrowhead, where would I be in this field? And I looked around, and there's a high point. I go, I think I should be up there. And I walk up there, and I look down, and there was a flake. Just a flake. I go, an exotic flake. So then I walked around, and I found a fluted point. And then after a while, I found, over the years, I found maybe three or four these pretty little quartz things. I'd like to show you one. I love them. There they are. It doesn't really, barely even look like an arrowhead. The bottom of it is that way. Uh, And that's halfway between the great game hunting fluted points and these eared Brewertons that I was showing you earlier. It really is sort of, you can see the evolutionary thing. It just developed ears. So what am I telling you? I was telling you the places in Concord. So one place is the fields behind Fox House, the Lakeshore culture there. There's a site at the stone wall between the Hanscom land and the Fox fields. Closer to here, behind Ripley School, there are some cornfields, and they back on the same waterway, the Cemetery Creek, and the what's called Thoreau's Bog, which is now a wetland behind Revolutionary Brook. Well, that was the Portage water, so everywhere along there, and there's houses along Birch Street and Maple Street. If I lived there, I'd be digging up my backyard, because that's where the arrowheads are, the most of them anyway, in Concord. It's true there are arrowheads by White's Pond. It's true that there are stemmed points on the field across from the rifle range. It's also true that there are stemmed points just west of Strawberry Hill Road, where it starts off of blah, 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 something, Barrett's Mill Road. And there's a name for that farm out there. I can't remember what it's called. So those are where the arrowheads are that I know of. I've heard that the 5% study of Concord found some arrowheads somewhere else, but I've never been able to figure out where that was. And I haven't 5%. Some archaeologists did a study of 5% of Concord, and they reported it. And one of them came up to me at an archaeology conference saying, "Oh, you're interested in Concord arrowheads? Well, let me tell you." And he proceeded to tell me that his survey had found some somewhere, but he couldn't tell me where because it was 20 years ago. And I didn't look up his study. I'm not a good scholar. There's a lot of information in this library. I'm out there looking for stuff, and I probably could do better if I knew more. But I wanted to mention that before me walking around in the fields of Concord, I'm proud to say that there was a fellow named Ben Smith who did very good mapping, and probably his collection probably 100 times bigger than mine. And before him was a fellow named Avery Toland, T-O-L-L-A-N-D. Now, he wrote The History of Concord, so you can go back and find out that. And before him was Henry David Thoreau, who had the small arrowhead collection that you can still see some of it in the Fruitlands Museum in Harvard. So it's a good tradition to be part of. But year after year, fewer and fewer fields are plowed, and it's harder and harder to find exposed surface that you can walk over. So I think arrowhead hunting is down to about as minimum an activity as it can be now. But they did just plow. This is May 24th, and it rained, and I'm going to be going to the field behind Ripley School probably after lunch, since I took the day off. I should go out to the field by the cemetery, I'm forgetting. You know, I'm spending all this time talking about nonsense and not telling you the good stories. I still want to tell you about stone mounds, and that's an important thing, and I hope we have time for it. Don't let me spend too much time talking about arrowheads, because they're not the most interesting story, actually, in my opinion. But I should tell you the story about the cemetery. I guess I told you that I had pretended to start a fight with the cemetery people. Mm-hmm. I'm getting old and rambling. And they actually, I guess I already did tell this story. Yeah, right. And they set aside a piece of ground, and there is today a plaque that I had a friend of mine's help, and he picked a rock out of his collection of rocks, and he lent me tools, and he told me how to carve it. And I designed a message and a sign, and I paid out of pocket for a bronze plaque, but I got reimbursed, luckily. But I bought a bronze plaque, which I designed, and I manufactured the hole in the rock that a plaque fits into, and my friend who's in construction and knows how to do these things helped me screw and glue the plaque into place, and we then brought it down here and had it unloaded from his pickup truck by the cemetery committee people in their front loader, and they then did the difficult work of placing the stone in there. But if you go in the new cemetery area that's just now east of Cemetery Brook, it's called the extension to Sleepy Hollow, and you go left, you'll see the only stone over there on the left today is my plaque. and hopefully it won't be surrounded by too many graves that people will become unaware of it. But I'm happy to say that I visited it, and there was a girl leaning up on it one time, and then there was another time that there was a dog had peed on it, and another time there was some rabbit tracks that went up to it. I go to visit my plaque just to see how it's doing, and it's part of the environment now. Dogs are peeing on it. Girls are hiding from their parents behind it. So it has some function, hopefully. And there are some new people out there hunting for arrowheads today. And there's a guy who comes down from New Hampshire, and I want to kill him because he's, like, raiding my territory. It's like, go back to New Hampshire. Get your own arrowheads, you want to think. But anyway, there's other people out there today. And I stopped and spoke with a young man and woman who were collecting together. And they had seen the plaque, and they had appreciated the plaque. So I felt that had it reached at least some audience.
So you wrote a message on it?
Yes.
You designed a message for
it? Yeah, it says, for 10,000 years, this has been a favorite home to people who lived by the rivers. It originally said something slightly different. It said, here for more than 10,000 years, the Europeans lived, blah, blah, blah. What I wanted to say was that the ground in the cemetery is stained red from the campfires of the people that stayed there. You have to have been part of the archaeological dig, which was downstream consequence of my making this fuss, was that the cemetery people paid for some archaeology. And, you know, it's just one of these archaeology lab people. They make their money by saying there's nothing here you can build. That's where they make their money. But anyway, these guys came out and dug a bunch of holes. And every other hole that they dug hit a fire pit, right? So these guys were out there. The first economy of Concord, if you don't count the lakeshore stuff and if you ignore the Paleo Indians, who were just a temporary presence up by the real stuff was in the Middle Archaic, where Concord was very busily occupied by these two different sets of people I was telling you about. And the great game would come out, go down to the river to water, and then they come back up to the flats of Bedford to eat, because this was a prairie. Between when it was lakes and now, it was also prairie. It's flat, sort of wet. It was, you know, perfect for I don't know, buffalo, something like that. Anyway, presumably they were hunting game up there. And I don't really know this, but I imagine them cooking it also. So you got campfires. I'll tell you one last story. One more story. When they dug the cemetery extension, the place that I'd fought them on, to the point that they left a little bit of it alone. But when they went to do it, first they stripped away the soil. Then they trenched roads because they wanted it to have certain contours when they were done, which, since it was a flat piece of land and they wanted it to be an unflat finished product, they had to dig down to get that effect and then remove soil. Basically, they removed chunks of... It was a flat surface before they got there. It was common ground, probably because of whatever... It was common land before it became owned by the cemetery. And you should hear the stories from Emerson and Dee and Shimoni about that eastern Concord and that piece of land in general. But when the cemetery committee went in there to build, the engineer trenched the roads at the places where it was going to be deeper. He dug down and then up. So that left soil profiles where you could see the dirt in profile from the side. And it was mostly just sand and gravel bedded with rust, maybe layers of rusty sand running through it. And so one place where they dug it, there was like a charred log sticking out of 6 feet down. And I think there's a charred log sticking out because somebody had a fire there, right? Another place, I'm looking along here at following the braided layers of sand and gravel, and suddenly they stop in their horizontal trajectory, and then they resume 5-10 feet later on the same horizontal trajectory. But between where they stopped and where they restarted, there was something that came down from it. It was all mixed in, and somebody had, it looked like the cross-section of a hole that had been dug into the bank, and I think it's about the only reasonable explanation for why the layers stopped, and then there was a homogeneous stretch, and then they resumed as layers beyond that. And, you know, and on the way from the top to the bottom of this hole, which is 8 feet deep, you're seeing little bits and pieces of charred stuff sticking out there. So we're talking fire pits 8 feet deep. Well, you know, you're talking campfires everywhere. So I wanted originally to say, you know, where you stand in the cemetery, this is the plaque that didn't get written, underneath your feet and all around are the red stains of their fires. I wanted to say that because it's like you're sitting in a place that was a city 8,000 years ago, and now it's just an empty field. But look to the southwest and think about the people who have passed. So I think that should be the end of my Arrowhead ranting, and now I should tell you a little bit about rock piles and a different part of the story. So, I don't know what the right way to, how did I get started with rock piles? You're walking around in the woods and you notice stone walls, but you don't pay too much attention to them. And somewhere along the line, I'll just put it this way, somebody told me that, gee, you know, not all those stone walls were made by farmers. Some of them were there beforehand. Somebody told me that. And you go, I don't believe you. I was always told that farmers made everything, right? Those hardy, resilient Yankee farmers, they're hardworking. They came into a wilderness. It turns out that America was by no means a wilderness. Actually, it was a garden, very carefully managed garden. And how many stone walls were here beforehand? We won't know until dating techniques catch up with the questions that we have. We don't know how to date a stone wall very well. But it is true, if you go out and look, that quite a large number of stone walls point towards astronomical events that are calendrical. So if you see a stone wall that points right to where the winter solstice sunset happens, it doesn't point to north or south, it points to that. And then you see that more than once, you start saying, why would somebody be building a stone wall where the only meaningful concept of that direction is as an astronomical concept? I probably shouldn't get too much into the subject, but it's very much considered fringe archaeology that the Native Americans built stuff in stone. They didn't build homes out of stone, but they built lots of stuff out of stone. They built fishing weirs, they built fire breaks, they built deer drive lines, they built...
I know what a weir is, but a deer drive line?
It's like where you put a stone wall into a funnel, and then the deer's got to run down. They don't want to jump the fence, so they run through the entrance of the funnel, and that's where you wait and get them. Something like that. They talk about drive lines.
So a deer weir.
Exactly. these are officially recognized Native American constructions, but everywhere in America except New England, Native Americans constructed the wazoo, as we say, and you have to wonder, well, why does it somehow stop when we get to New England? And the answer is, it doesn't stop. Belief stops when you get to New England. New England has a peculiar history, which, since this is my story, I will tell you what I believe, okay? For better or for worse, when the you can read this story in Trespassing by John Hanson Mitchell. You know, the first pilgrims, when they got here, their first act was to go ashore and steal a kettle with some corn in it. And I think 20 years or so later, the Indians were still trying to get their kettle back because the pilgrims, they said to themselves, there's nobody here. Look, it's an abandoned village. Why, we can take this pot of corn. It doesn't belong to anybody. There's no one here. So the theft of New England by the Anglos was predicated, since these were ethical people, biblical, you know, Christian people. You couldn't steal, but you could occupy that which had been abandoned by a non-existent, long-gone people. The idea that the Native Americans didn't exist was built into the land acquisition mentality, and it became ingrained in the history books of New England. The non-existence of the Native Americans became a matter of law. It's required that the Indians don't exist. We cannot tolerate the possibility that they exist.
A matter of law?
Yeah. In other words, we got to take this land, therefore they don't exist. I don't know how to put it. It became, there's a word for this, it became canon. It became the canon. Is that the phrase? Mm-hmm. Was that they didn't exist. In fact, they continued to exist. And hey, here's a big secret. They still exist now. Whoever's listening to this tape, there are Indians out there now.
Here?
Yeah, here. I saw some Indians in the library not too long ago, although I doubt that they were New England Indians. They're probably some other tribe. But... I'm going to tell you about some of the things that Indians do in the woods, did in the woods, and continue to do in the woods. And it has to do with stone mounds. And one of the standard things that you hear is, oh, well, that was only built 30 years ago. Therefore, it must have been European You go, well, you're forgetting the Indians are still here now. And the thing I'm shocked by, and I'm trying to give some context to this statement in a few minutes, is that I was watching cowboys and Indians on TV, and they were out in my backyard sneaking around. Can you believe that? And if you're from around here, you're from
West Virginia.
West Virginia. You got Indians sneaking around down in West Virginia, I guarantee it. And if they've been driven out of a place just because you don't think they're there anymore doesn't mean that they're not there anymore. See, the Anglos like to think that we came and occupied New England, and the Indians were gone at the time, and they've never come back. The last Indian was in 1821, and then there was another last Indian in 1873. I'm making these numbers up. And then there was another last Indian. Truth is that there's been a small Native American presence in New England at all times, and they're doing quite well, thank you very much. The Narragansetts have their thing going on in Rhode Island. You got the Wampanoags actually expanding their existence down in the Cape and in Mashpee. You have the Nipmuc inland, who didn't keep good tribal records, and so they're not a recognized tribe, although, in my opinion, they seem to have a better mental continuity of these things than some of the more officially recognized and established tribes. And I wish some of the things I'm about to tell you could be used to help them gain tribalhood, because they deserve it as much as anybody else, even if the Narragansetts are contemptuous of the Nipmuc because the Nipmuc have forgotten who they are. Nonetheless, they're Indian, and they have been here all along, and they deserve some kind of credit for things, or some kind of, they did used to own everything, so whatever. Meanwhile, I'm getting chased out of Littleton by some urbanized guy going, I don't know you, I'm going to call the police. Somehow it seems like all part of the same picture. But anyway, I'm trying to figure out how to start this story. I heard that there was funny stuff in the woods. I started looking more carefully at what was in the woods. I noticed rock piles, little piles of rock, in a couple different places in Acton. And then I was walking in Acton, and you know, people tell you that when you see a pile of rocks, it's because somebody was clearing a field and getting the rocks out of a field. And then if you press them and say something like, well, there's no field for any miles around here, they come up with some other thing. Well, yeah, but you know, it's also for a trail marking. Yeah, but there's no trail here, and there's four of them in a row. No, they're not in a row, there's in a circle. They go, oh yeah, well, they were just building the rock piles because somebody was going to come along and put them into a truck and ship them somewhere, and they were staged, and that was sort of how you made a pallet of rock. They put them in a pile. They'll tell you these sorts of things. And then you come back and say, yeah, but this is on top of a mountain in Vermont, and there's no rocks. Nobody was harvesting rocks from the top of the mountain. They go, well, I don't know what that was about. And then they go off somewhere else. They just won't answer the questions. So anyway, you hear that there's these funny things. You're walking around looking at stuff. You say, well, gee, you know, there's an awful lot of rock piles in the woods in Acton, because, I mean, I noticed them. Then I'm walking along, and I came across something which was very obviously from field clearing, right? So at the edge of a field, now my story is going to expand outside of Concord now, if that's permissible. Acton and Carlisle were part of Concord, and Concord was the first frontier town, but I regard all of Middlesex County as being the extension of Concord, essentially. So where am I in the story? Yeah. Okay, Weatherby Road, I guess, in Acton, there's a cornfield there where I did find one Paleo-Indian point at a time. Anyway, you go up to the top of the field, and you will see sort of up at the top, a little bit to the left, you will see big piles of rocks, and you will see big rocks in a big circle with smaller rocks dumped into them, and then even smaller rocks dumped on top of those. Then you'll see another pile over here that's just smaller rocks, okay? And the way they cleared a field was first you take the biggest ones out, and maybe you'd put them in a pile, or you'd make a little circle or something. Then you take the next bigger ones out, and you dump them in their own pile or maybe on top of the larger ones. And then eventually you get down to rocks that are just about 5-6 inches across, and you haul out baskets and baskets of them, and you just dump them on there, so you'd see these little piles of small ones. It's very easy to recognize this as you know, there's no mistaking it when you see it. It leaves a pile that's basically at the angle of repose, meaning, you know, it's made the way rocks would be if they came to rest when you tossed them into a pile. There's no attempt of tidying up the edges. The edges are It's not circular or rectangular, it's just an uneven outline. And in particular, they are sorted by size so that you see the big ones in one place and then another bunch of middle-sized ones and a bunch of smaller-sized ones. Now, I was looking at that, and then the same day or the other day, I saw this pile over on Spring Hill in Acton. You go to the end of Spring Hill Road in Acton, go 50 yards to the right, and you will see there a trail marker, which has three dots on it indicating rock piles. And I'd love to tell you the story about how Acton became the first town to acknowledge the existence of rock piles and have started designing their trail program, their trails, around some of this resource. Because what they have is a bunch of archaeological sites, which are equivalent to Stonehenge or the mounds in Ohio, but they're small and subtle and very, very uniquely New England-y. And they're very common, and I'll get into that more. But anyway, I'm just trying to tell you the act of discovery here, which isn't really my discovery because somebody already told me there's funny stuff in the woods. But how did I come to believe it myself was I'm looking at rock piles in Spring Hill, and the rock piles are small. They're about 4 or 5, 8 feet across. They're built up with vertical walls. All the rocks are about as big as a rock could be to carry it. They're not mixed together. They're built in stacks, and they're filling a whole acre of land, scrappy land, never got plowed. They're in lines. They're evenly spaced. They're forming a grid. They're nothing like this pile over on Weatherby Avenue, which is obviously a field clearing pile. If you want to know what field clearing looks like, go to Great Book Farm in Carlisle. Go to behind the farmhouse. Go to the bottom of the field. Look at those piles of rock around the edge. That's what field clearing looks like. You want to see field clearing, go to Weatherby. Go to the top of the field. Take a left top. Look what field clearing piles look like. Then you want to see something that's obviously different. Go to the top of Spring Hill Road and look there at those things. Turns out that there's a whole bunch of little rock piles in the woods that if you're trying to fit them into a hypothesis of an agrarian practical use, such as disposal of rocks, it just doesn't work. And a different hypothesis is, well, the Native Americans built that for some reason, which we're still trying to understand, but it's a better explanation because, for example, I have on my maps here where all the rock piles are found in the Bill Ricca Quadrangle. These pencil marks here. And this is the same map that is part Concord, the Maynard Quadrangle. And as it turns out, where these rock piles are located is along this body of land here, which is the Neshoba, it's sort of the edge of the Neshoba upthrust. It's actually an interesting geological feature. There's sort of a vein of limestone that runs through here and all the way up to Cape Ann. And I'm not sure why all the rock piles are mostly associated with that piece of land. I think it's because it's high ground, it's scrappy ground. It's where farming never had a chance to destroy them. So farming doesn't create rock piles. There's plenty of rocks in Concord, but there are very few rock piles. I could tell you that as a matter of fact.
The fields were cleared for agriculture?
Yeah, but they weren't cleared into piles. They were cleared into walls.
So the piles are for what?
In both instances.
Weatherby and Spring Hill.
Those are for, at Weatherby, the field was cleared. It's a field clearing.
For agriculture.
For agriculture. At Spring Hill.
Native people.
Farmers farming. It's an uninteresting thing. Farmers disposed of it. It's true. Farmers occasionally would dump their rocks at the edge of the field, usually at the lower end of the field. It's not an uncommon thing. But much of Carlisle and Acton is rocky country. It was never plowed. It's swampy, rocky, remaindered land. And the only agrarian use of it that ever was cutting down trees. You wouldn't even let your livestock in there because they'd break their ankles on the rocks. So we're talking about land that was never disturbed, and that's where all the rock piles are. It's actually, if you look at the overall thing, it's where hills meet water. It's where, these are the sources of many of the brooks are coming out of here. It's where hills meet water, and they're not all the same types of things. It's understood that Native Americans would create donation piles as memorials, What's not understood is that the Native Americans, for example, had a very complex astronomy. So for instance, at Spring Hill, which is a place that we've now surveyed three times, it looks a lot like the rock piles are lined up with the solstices, but we don't know yet what's going on. It's still a puzzle. It's a little bit like, some of these megalithic sites in Europe, they haven't figured out. You know, they're still trying to figure out Stonehenge, right? You'd think that they'd know by now, right? So anyway, there are rock piles in the woods, and I have gotten interested in them, and I started looking for them. And I have now found more rock pile sites than anybody believed existed. I have on the maps here something like 500 or more individual rock pile sites. Every one of these is an archaeological site, in my opinion, and they're all worth preserving, and they're all beautiful. I mean, if I took you to one of these, you'd go, wow, that's funny. I never saw anything like that. And then I think a lot of people have seen these, but they've only seen it once. So you go, wow, that's funny. That's interesting. Yawn. But it's like I got interested in, because cheap gas and, I'm responsible for the gusher and the Gulf as much as anybody else. But I've been driving around looking every weekend, twice a weekend, driving, looking. So I got to know I can say with a certain amount of pride that I've been up every hill in Middlesex County, and nobody else alive can say that. I've been in almost every conservation land. I've poked my nose in everywhere because I wanted to know and look.
This is amazing.
And look at all these sites. They're all over the place. And every one of them is interesting. So now, Concord. Let me speak about the places in Concord. This is important. There are two major hills in Concord. I wonder if any of your other oral historians have mentioned that. One of them is called Punkatasset Hill. The other was called Unersnack Hill. I can't tell you what those mean, except I believe...
Spell, please.
Let's see. Unersnack, A-N-N-U-R-S-N-A-C. Now, somehow that word is associated with eating strawberries. Unersnack. It's Strawberry Hill Road, and strawberries. So I'm wondering, is it possible that Anur means strawberry and snack means snack?
In what language?
Algonquin. Algonquin is full of non-Algonquin words.
And the other spelling of the other hill, please?
Punkatasset. Let's see. On the map, it's P-U-N-K. Are you writing?
I'm listening.
Okay. P-U-N-K-A-T-A-S-S-E-T. Punkatasset Hill. Just look at my map here for a second. You'll notice that both of these hills have a big rock pile site on their northern sides. So y'all just go check it out. But if you get to the northern side of Punkatasset Hill, you walk back and forth, you'll see the rock pile site there. You do the same on Unersnack Hill, you'll see the rock pile site there. It's quite a big one. I don't know if these involve burials or not. So here's a question that one could ask. Where are the Native American burial grounds? Where are the Indian burial grounds? I mean, everybody's, since we all watch TV, we all know about the old Indian burial ground. Thoreau mentions, I'm not a Thoreau scholar, but I read a little bit of his Concord and Merrimack, 7 days on the Concord and Merrimack, or that book. He took a trip with his brother in a boat. And as they float past Billerica, they make the comment that they can see the Indian graveyard on the hillside. And you're going, come on, Thoreau, tell me what you see. He just mentions seeing it, doesn't mention what it looks like. It's probably the case that some of the Native Americans buried their dead underneath rock piles. Some of the Native Americans buried their dead in one place and put other rock piles that are not burials but are part of the memorial nearby. And more or less, it's a reasonable guess that a lot of this has to do with mortuary practices. So I will tell you where the Native American graveyard is in Concord, and you keep this to yourself, okay?
Well, this is going on.
I know, but who's going to think to go to the library to figure out where to go pot hunting, right? So I'm going to tell you how to find the Yellow Birch Swamp burial ground, okay? This is, if I had one secret to tell the town of Concord, this is it, because even the most expert people with Estabrook Woods have never seen this. And I was pleased to show, because we've got some real experts on Estabrook Woods, and you show them something that they've never seen before in Estabrook Woods, they should naturally feel a little embarrassed that they missed that. But anyway, you go up Two Rod Road, You go past Hutchins Pond, it's on your left, and you stay on Two Rod Road, and you go about a quarter of a mile, maybe a little less, and you'll see a stone wall coming in perpendicular to the road on your right. We're going north on Two Rod Road. Are we okay?
Yep.
Out of Concord, we're going north on Two Rod Road into Yellow Birch Swamp. About a quarter of a mile, a little bit less, you see a stone wall coming in from the right, perpendicular to the road, and not coming quite up to the road. If you look to your left, you'll see that the stone wall actually resumes to the west of the road. And if you want, you can go down to that stone wall to where it hits another stone wall at the edge.